I call the Senate Resources Committee meeting to order. Today is Monday, March 6th. The time is 3:30 p.m. Committee members present, Senator Kawasaki, Senator Klayman, Vice Chair Senator Wilkowski, Senator Dunbar, and my co-chair, Senator Bishop. I believe Senator Coffin will be along shortly. We have a quorum to conduct business. The recording secretary is Carrie Cooper-Ryder today, and our LIO moderator is Amanda Kraft. Both of you, thank you for making this meeting possible. Please silence your cell phones. So today we're going to start discussion of Senate Bill 49. So this is carbon capture, utilization, and storage. We have two experts today who will be presenting to us. First of all, we're going to hear from Mr. David Greeson. He is the president of Proven Project Development Group, who has been recognized worldwide as a carbon capture project specialist. So, Mr. Greeson, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your presentation. I will keep track of the time, and at 4:15, in other words, 45 minutes into this meeting, we'll move to the next speaker. So I'll let you time yourself or arrange your slides thusly, but I'll keep you apprised of the time. So thank you so much for joining us. If you'd introduce yourself and proceed.
All right, let's see. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you now.
Okay. My name is David Greeson. Thank you so much for the opportunity to speak to the committee. I work in the carbon capture industry. I've done a number of projects. I've also testified before Congress about this subject, so I am very happy to be here. As I've mentioned to the chairman before, I am all about helping us as a planet figure out how to continue to use carbon-based fuels, fossil fuels, and so that is the reason I'm here testifying. All right, so I have been around the industry a while. As you can see from my bio here, I've been in the industry for quite a while, 40 some odd years. Sorry, I'm trying to get my version of this because I can't quite see the screen on the video here. If you'll bear with me one second. By the way, thank you for the opportunity to speak with you through video conference. It's very helpful for me and my schedule. Okay, next slide, please. So I understand that primarily we're looking at storage, but I wanted to kind of give an overview of the whole carbon capture process. Start with on the far left of this. I am from the power industry, so, you know, to a hammer, everything looks like a nail. So I'm going to use a power example in most of my examples today, but I do have some slides that talk about other industries. So we have a power plant, which represents a source of flue gas where something is being combusted. Carbon dioxide is in the flue gas. It's being emitted to the atmosphere. And we're wanting to do something about that. So we put a carbon capture system, direct the flue gas out of the unit, whether it's a boiler or a heater in a refinery, anything that combusts fuel, direct the flue gas into a system that the state-of-the-art technology these days is captures more than 90% of the carbon dioxide entrained in the flue gas. In fact, most technology providers are offering 95% guarantees where they'll capture 95% of whatever CO2 you send to them, they'll capture. So what happens in the flue gas after it's been cleaned is emitted to the atmosphere as it was before, but this time it's less than 1% CO2. The pure CO2, the state-of-the-art technology, just by its physics and nature, makes almost food grade carbon dioxide. It's very pure. It should be very important for your geologists to know as you're thinking about storage, the constituents in the stream of CO2 will matter to geochemistry. So you'll want to know exactly what's in that, and some processes have other contaminants that need to be dealt with because they have effects to the rock and the metallurgy of the injection systems. But in our case, when we're talking about liquid amine capture systems, it's almost food grade and it's really generally not an issue. Then there's a transport component. I'm working on a project in North Dakota that sits right on top of the storage facility. So they'll be injecting directly beneath the power plant. Transport is not an issue. Many other carbon capture projects around the lower 48 are running into issues with running pipelines to connect the carbon capture system and the source with the storage facility. Pipelines, unfortunately, are a target. They are, as we all in the industry know, the safest way to transport anything. But unfortunately, because it can affect landowners, they make a good target. I will say that in the Petranova project that we'll talk about here in a few minutes, my only real protractor or detractor, the guy that organized against us the most, organized against us because we bypassed him when we built the pipeline. He has a lot of pipes on his property. He makes a lot of money off of selling right-of-ways, and he was upset whenever we went around him. So landowner issues are a big issue. Sometimes not always what you think. You think by going around somebody, you've done them a favor, but in this case, it turned out not to be helpful to the process. All right, so I understand you have other witnesses that are going to talk more about subsurface, so I won't go into that, but I'm certainly available to tell you what I do know when we get to the Q&A. Next slide, please. Okay, so one thing that I'd like to impress upon this committee and the legislature in general, the Department of Energy is being funded by Congress to take the brunt or bear the load as it relates to research. There are some states that have tried to fill the gap on that. They've tried to come up with other incentives, and it really works better for the DOE to take that. The sheer size of the dollars we're talking about tend to be better borne by the federal government than state governments. So they also have a infrastructure for conducting those kinds of researches and demonstrations that ensures discipline, the money is spent properly, at least it's supposed to work that way. So I would encourage you, as you think about policy, to think about filling in the gaps for deployment, not the research. There are many site-specific issues that have to be dealt with. As a developer of a carbon capture or a storage system. And so that's where the state can really help out with policy on what happens long-term for the CO2, what is the classification of any pipelines that need to be built? Are they common carriers? Are they not? What rights do they have to encourage landowners to be a part, or what the policies are? So that's where, in my experience as in developing carbon capture systems, that states have the biggest impact. Next slide, please. So I live in Texas. I'm near Houston, and a couple of the clients that I'm consulting with are here in the state. Some of the policymakers have asked me to talk a little bit about what Texas can do further to enhance our opportunities. We make 60%, I think, of state revenues are either directly or indirectly tied to some kind of fossil fuel. And so if if the world is wanting lower carbon products, then we should, as a state, think about policies that will help our industries decarbonize. And so we have, as you can see from this slide, we're on the far left there. We have a burden to bear, although most of the products that we're making here are for the benefit of the rest of the country. Because the carbon emissions are here in this state, people tend to look at us and say, you're the worst of all, even though they're buying the products that cause those emissions in the first place. But if you look out to the right, you can see that Alaska is not the problem. It's states like Texas, California, Florida. Those are the big emitters. And so for capture policy, if we want this country to have an impact, then it's those states that need to think about incentivizing not only storage, but capture as well. So if you go to the next slide, I want to talk a little bit about what the capture side is facing, the economic challenges that they face in order to get a project pulled together. As one storage landowner told me, you know, you can capture all the carbon dioxide you want, but if you don't have a place to store it, you don't have a project. So therefore, I think I'm creating the value, not you. So let's just take a look at what was driving the economics of carbon capture and storage. So this is a chart that I pulled out of a report by the National Petroleum Council. It was a two-year effort. Lots of industry experts contributed to it. And so it's actually been peer-reviewed with real peers, and I think we can trust that these numbers are indicative of what the industry is facing as a whole. Now, that said, any one project is going to not necessarily follow. These are somewhat averages, and so some projects will cost more, some will cost less. This is kind of generally what is being faced by these categories. So the low-hanging fruit for capturing carbon dioxide is not surprising. It's natural gas processing. The off-gas from that process is 90% CO2. Ethanol, it's 90 to 95% CO2. So there's not a lot of separation needed in those cases. And in the case of ammonia, it can be as much as 99% CO2 already coming out of the tailpipe of that facility. So separating is not near as expensive as it is for the more dilute capture system or sources. Hydrogen producers and cement plants are next. The CO2 concentration in their flue gas tends to be in the 20 to 30% range. That's why they're more expensive than ethanol or ammonia, but they're less expensive than many of the other source types. And out on the far right, starting with refinery, fluidized catalytic crackers, FCCs, and on to the right. See, those are somewhat clustered in the same level on the y-axis of this graph. It's because most of these are in the 10% range of flue gas concentration. They're already up there. Okay, so I've shown, okay, well, that's what it costs to capture, and that's just capture, by the way. It doesn't include storage. How does that figure, and how does that compare with what the federal government is paying? Well, in the U.S., right now, the wind industry is getting about $61 a ton for tax credits, subsidies for its low carbon product, which is power. For the fossil fuel or for point source carbon capture, the Congress passed a law last year that raised the credit to $85 per ton. And while that looks like there's a differential there that is hard to explain, the wind guys are not obligated to make product. And so you can think about their product as being intermittent. It has less value. It has less value to society. And so that, to me, it makes sense that they wouldn't be paid as much per ton captured because it's not predictable, it's not controllable. It just happens when it happens. And I think in most places around the country, I know it's true here in Texas, the wind blows when nobody wants the power, and when everybody needs the power, the wind doesn't blow. So the relative value of the products being produced, I think, is appropriate with the tax credit value. Okay, next slide. So let's break it down a little bit more here so you can see what the components are. You can deliver to the fence line pipeline-ready carbon dioxide at an ethanol plant for about $30 a metric ton. For the average power plant, and this is the average, it's about $104 per metric ton. Now, that $104 average includes some that can deliver on the power plant side, some that can deliver for about $50 a ton. And it also includes some that, if you were to spend the money on carbon capture, would be $150 a ton. So that's kind of the range of specific projects that are driving that average. What's likely to happen in the carbon capture industry is there are those really expensive plants also tend to be the older facilities, and so more than likely they won't ever be considered for investment in carbon capture. So it'll mostly be the plants that are in the $50 to $75 per ton range. And the reason for that is almost nowhere in the States are markets offering more for carbon-free power. Wind power trades the same. I live in Texas. We have retail choice. If I went into the retail market to buy power for my house, I could buy from wind, I can buy from firm resources, and the price is the same. There's no differentiation in the market for low carbon products, especially in the power industry. So the $85 tax credit has to pay for all of the carbon capture, or you're not going to sell your product in the market. People aren't going to pay. People aren't currently willing to pay more for power unless they're forced to. So I think that we'll see quite a bit of the coal-fired fleet in the U.S., about half that will be eligible for carbon capture will actually see a project proposed, because you'll need that extra cushion. If you can capture and deliver carbon dioxide for $50 to $60 per ton, that leaves another $20 to $25 a ton for paying for the transport to your storage facility and the storage itself. Okay, next slide. So in that National Petroleum Council report, it's called the Meeting the Dual Challenge, here are the values that they put together for what the total $110 per ton for power plants, what that breaks down and where it breaks down. You can see transport and storage is roughly a third of the cost in their estimation. We're seeing storage operators and people with large tracts here on the Gulf Coast quote storage fees of anywhere from $7 to $14 a metric ton. And the transporters, the pipelines that we see are quoting about that same range for their service as well. So anywhere from $14 to $30 a ton is being asked. So far, I'm not aware of any firm transactions that have been done, but that's what a lot of these projects that are being proposed, they're in early development. They're looking for quotes from transport and storage developers, and they're getting quotes in that $14 to $30 range. Okay, next slide. So who are the likely customers for, if you're looking to bring CO2 in from offshore, who are the sources that are going to be likely to be the first ones to bite the bullet and pay for transport? And in my estimation, it's going to be the ammonia and the hydrogen group out on the far right. What this graph shows is that the cost of carbon capture is directly related to how dilute or how concentrated the CO2 is in the flue gas. So as you move to the right in this graph, you see sources that are more concentrated in the CO2 content of the flue gas. And as you move to the left, you run into more sources that are less concentrated. And I've indicated the concentration at the bottom. Natural gas combined cycle, this is the typical power plant configuration that's built for natural gas these days. It's about 3%, which is very dilute, very hard to capture the CO2 in such a dilute stream. The coal-fired plants that make up the majority of my customers are around 11%. That's actually somewhat of a sweet spot for the liquid amine technology. And then as we move to cement and SMR, steam methane reforming, you get into the higher concentration. Now, there in a steam methane reformer, there are two tailpipes, one that has about 10% CO2 concentration, and the other is nearly pure CO2 concentration. So this is the combination of both tailpipes to get to the 22% estimate. All right, so next slide, please. So I get asked quite a bit, if it's so expensive and it takes so much government subsidy, why even do it? Why don't we just close it all down and live off renewables? Well, there's a whole debate and group of people who can talk to us about trying to live off of intermittent power. But what this graph shows is when you build enough copies and you put enough horsepower, brain power to work on lowering the cost. In the case of solar, the industry was able to get its cost down to less than half of what it originally was when it started. And so since we only have one operating in the States anyway, one operating carbon capture system, we have another one at Boundary Dam in Canada in Saskatchewan. So there's two in North America that are capturing CO2. We're going to see as more and more of these projects get deployed, using the $85 tax credit that Congress has given us, we're going to see the cost come down. And I've talked to all the major technology vendors. They talk to me. We consult all the time. And they're already seeing opportunities for reducing the cost in the next generation of capture systems that they plan to build. So there's reason for hope. We're not just jousting at windmills here. This is an industry, like all industries, that will, as we build more copies, will come down in cost. Okay, so my last slide, and then we can open it up for questions or move to the next speaker and then do questions altogether, whatever the committee would like. I'm here for the whole time, whatever you would like. The most important thing that a carbon capture developer is looking for is primacy in the States. If you don't have primacy, you're number one having to wait on EPA to have a time slot to take up your application. Number two, as you're trying to inject CO2 and work with the agency on something that's not been done before on scale, right? This is something that policy is going to evolve on, techniques are going to evolve on, and you want local agency people that know your geology, that know your state, to be administering the Class 6 program. So there's one thing that I can leave with you to take away is, even though I'm not talking about storage, I'm here to tell you as a developer, I'm looking for states that have primacy or are about to get primacy. Another big thing that solves a lot of problems and takes a lot of risk out of a whole the whole value chain of carbon capture is if public lands can be used for carbon capture. It's one landowner. The landowner is creditworthy. The landowner is usually sophisticated and has people and agencies that can know how to manage the storage facility once it's turned back to them. And if you think about it, I hesitate to use this example, but it's kind of the best parallel example is we look to our municipal and state governments for landfills to facilitate not only our homes, but our businesses, just to enable commerce to go on, because with a certain way to handle our waste streams. It just seems very consistent that states should also provide an opportunity for handling this carbon dioxide stream as well. So another thing that is very helpful to developers is who is going to take the long-term liability. And while it is very helpful, obviously, for the state to be the one that takes it, almost as importantly is certainty around this issue. Who is it going to be? If it's going to be the state, that's like a double win. But if state law, a state policy establishes very clearly who that is, then business can react to that. We can figure out insurance products or risk products or figure out how to share the risk together. We can move forward if we know what the rules are. And so long-term liability, I didn't put in the slide state necessarily because I wanted to make the point that certainty around who it is just almost as important as if it's the state actually taking the long-term liability. So with that, I hope I've kind of given you an overview of the issues that we're facing on the carbon capture side. And I am available to either answer questions or wait till the end, whatever you would like to do.
Thank you, Mr. Greeson. Questions for Mr. Greeson? Yes, Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you. Do you know how long it's typically taking states to get Class 6 permitting primacy?
The last one, I believe, was Wyoming, and that was 3 years for them.
Senator Kawasaki, did you have a question?
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks for being online today, Mr. Greeson. I had a question just sort of because we're discussing legislation here, just sort of what the market overall is and whether there actually is a market for carbon capture and storage.
So if your capture system is in the United States, Senator, there is a huge scramble on right now for carbon capture projects. The Congress not only upped the tax credit to $85, but they allow what's called direct pay for the first 5 years of the 12-year program. And what that allows us to do, it's very helpful. What we were facing, if they hadn't allowed direct capture, was the capital markets can only absorb so much at a time. And so we would be going as an industry to the tax equity market for billions of dollars of project equity financing. And what allowing us this five-year runway does is allows us to spread that out over time. So that's taken one of the risks off the table is are you going to be able to find tax equity to finance your project if everybody's charging into the market at the same time? Well, now what developers are doing is saying, we're willing to take the risk because at $85, the first best projects can actually get their money back, payback, simple payback, in about 5 years. And so they're saying, okay, I may not make any money, but I can at least get my money back before I have to refinance this in the tax equity market. So it gives me 5 years to find a counterparty to jump in. So I guess that's a long-winded answer to say there are a lot of people I turn down clients almost weekly looking to start projects in the U.S. Overseas, it's more difficult because they haven't, well, the tax credit just is not paralleled anywhere else in the world.
Follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So in your biography, you mentioned Petronova in Houston, a $1 billion project, one of the largest of its kind. Is that still operational?
So thank you, Senator, for the chance to talk about that. I should have mentioned it in my prepared remarks. It is in the process of being restarted. That project was developed at a time when there was no tax credit available. And so I was charged by our CEO at NRG to find a way to make the project work. And because the power plant is in a competitive market, I had to do it in a way where I couldn't look to the power plant to pay for carbon capture. Carbon capture had to pay for itself. So what Petronova is an oil company. We bought 50% interest in an oil field that was very near the end of its productive life, but also an oil field that was very ready for a secondary enhanced oil recovery project. So Petronova included an embedded carbon capture system, but it was really an oil company, and it was an oil company that, because we had to use carbon dioxide that we captured from a power plant, it was a high-cost producer. We needed oil prices to be in the $30 per range just to recover our lifting cost. And in order to amortize capital, we needed oil prices to be in the $75 range. When we closed on that plant, oil was $110 a barrel. And so we thought, we only need 75, it's at 110. We know the market's going to fluctuate, but surely 75 long term is where the market is. Well, before we completed the construction, oil prices had dipped back down to 30. So we ran the plant for 3 years, not at a loss. We did make some money on selling oil. I think the average oil price during that time was about $45 a barrel. So we made about $15 a barrel during that time. But then at the end of the three-year period that the Department of Energy required that we run for demonstration purposes, we shut down the carbon capture system, lowered our lifting cost to $15 a barrel, and then continued to use the carbon dioxide that we had built up in those 3 years to produce oil for the following 3 years. You can look on the Railroad Commission of Texas website and see that they continued to produce quite a bit of oil, several thousand barrels a day, even after carbon dioxide stopped flowing. So now with the tax credit available and oil prices seeming to be a little more sustained at a higher level, the owners, I'm retired now from that company, but they're looking at restarting, and they've made an announcement 2 weeks ago that they're actively working on restaffing and restarting.
Certainly. One more follow-up.
Yeah, just a really quick clarification. Thank you, Mr. Greeson. You mentioned the tax credits. Are the tax credits necessary from the federal government to be economic?
Yes. The cost to deliver carbon dioxide to the fence line is $60 per ton. And the electric market, the gasoline market, any market that produces a product that also has CO2 emissions is a very competitive market, and you can't pass that cost along to your product consumers because not everybody's doing it. If everybody was installing carbon capture, then no, we could all raise our prices enough on power, gasoline, whatever, to pay for it, but the federal tax credit is needed for those that are willing to put carbon capture on their systems.
Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Reason, for this presentation. So you indicated in one of these graphs that Alaska doesn't actually produce very much carbon. So if we're looking for large-scale carbon storage projects, we're going to have to import our carbon. You know, and so you talk about delivering to the fence line. Our fence line is sort of our state border or the Pacific Ocean, you know, or all of Canada. And so I guess, you know, on slide 8, you said $27 per ton for transport costs. How would you make that pencil in Alaska? Like if you were advising on a client on trying to store carbon in Alaska, how would you get carbon here economically? And how would it pencil, you know, if we're talking about interstate or even international, you know, carbon markets?
Well, pipelines from sources in North America would be one possible way. There are two pipelines that run from Colorado down to Texas that are each about 1,000 miles long. I believe Denbury owns a pipe that is from Jackson Dome, Mississippi, to a point just south of Houston. And I believe that's 300 or 400 miles long. So long-haul pipelines are a possibility. There is a project in the North Sea that is looking at shipping carbon dioxide to a depleted gas field out in the North Sea. There's platforms that will reverse the flow on some of those wells and make them injectors, and they'll inject CO2 there. I participated in a study the Department of State conducted looking at a potential carbon capture project in Greece. One of the ways the carbon dioxide was stored was shipping it to the Middle East, where they're desperate for carbon dioxide for enhanced oil recovery. And so literally we would look at an LNG style tanker built for purpose that would take carbon dioxide to the Middle East, where it would be injected into oil fields and permanently stored.
Thank you. I'm going to have members hold their questions. We're going to turn now to our next speaker, who will be discussing actual Alaska project. That's Mr. Frank Pascvan. If you would come forward, Mr. Pascvan. Mr. Greason will be here, of course, later for additional questions, if there are any. So Mr. Pascvan is an affiliate professor at the University of Alaska Fairbanks at the Institute of Northern Engineering. He's doing research on Alaska carbon capture, utilization, and sequestration, and has been doing it now for several years. I'll let you discuss that, Mr. Pascvan, and take us through your presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you all for making time to discuss carbon capture here in Alaska. This presentation is actually based upon a Society of Petroleum Engineers paper that we have in preprint now. That I and my co-authors, who are listed on the screen there as well, prepared for the Western Region annual meeting, which is actually going to be held in Anchorage in May of this year. So we can refer to the paper, which will be available for publication around May of this year, and it discusses this topic in more detail. Today I'll discuss our state carbon capture work group, and why we're interested in carbon capture, kind of who else is interested in carbon capture, and some Alaska carbon capture opportunities. It's really fun to be back in Juneau, and my grandfather came here to work on the gold mines in 1909, and my father, I believe, served as an MP here during World War II, and I just got off the phone with my brother, and he says hello to everyone, and he was a former senator and co-chair of Senate Resources. So it's great to be here, and to introduce myself, I am with the University of Alaska Fairbanks Institute of Northern Engineering. I spent 36 years in the oil and gas industry, working predominantly in Alaska, but also overseas in Indonesia and some time in Texas. I was born and raised in Fairbanks, went to petroleum engineering school there, and when BP left the state, I wanted to stay here. This is my home, and was asked to step in to help out with carbon capture by Brent Sheets at the university because of the growing interest. And so the UAF joined the Plain CO2 Reduction Partnership based out of North Dakota, who's an industry leader in this. So we've been a part of PCORE, or the Plain CO2 Reduction Workshop, since 2019, and I started working on this myself in 2021. So I'm a reservoir engineer doing reservoir modeling and field appraisal, a lot of subsurface experience, also gas injection. And Alaska is one of the world's leaders in gas injection projects for enhanced oil recovery. And the earlier presenter talked about carbon dioxide as a key resource for enhanced oil recovery. And it's a huge potential resource to enable that as well. And I share a bit of my background there because Alaska has many other engineers and geoscientists who are available with this kind of experience, which is really a key enabler for the industry to get going. So that's a bit of background there. And I guess, by the way, I'm very open to taking questions during the presentation. So if folks are interested, please just stop me, and I'll be happy to take questions if the chair agrees with that. So this is a bit of a discussion about the Alaska Carbon Capture Work Group and what our focus is. Our work group's mission is to accelerate commercial carbon capture projects in Alaska. And the why there is to attract new investments and also to create options to decarbonize activities which are vital to the state's economy. That includes power generation, keeping the lights and heat on, that includes refineries, and that includes oil and gas production. So we see when I and my co-leads on the work group formed this work group, we broke ourselves into four subcommittees, and those are the four you see at the bottom here. The first step and fundamental, really, is developing a state legal and regulatory framework. That's the, you know, we're a country ruled by law, and we need to have that, make it legal to make pore space available for these projects. There's funding opportunities, which I'll mention here, that are coming out on a monthly basis now, and we are tracking those. Also important is public outreach and education. And finally, putting those elements together, the technology and the economics, kind of get a sense of what a roadmap would look like for the state to accelerate commercial carbon capture. So here's a bit on the Alaska Carbon Capture Work Group. We started in July 2022. It was a continuation of our group that prepared a coordinated Alaska response to a Department of Energy request for information. That's a DOE RFI, which we prepared, a group of us prepared in the December-January timeframe, and it was sent to the DOE in January 2022. Let's see, we affectionately call that the RFI that stole Christmas, because it's 80 pages long and has a ton of additional information on carbon capture opportunities in the state. After we got together for that, to prepare that response, we decided that there was a lot of interest and and it would be a good idea to get a work group together. It'd be a good idea, thank you, to get a work group together, which would allow us to continue the conversations which we had during the preparation of that response. So we have over 100 people who have attended these meetings. At any given meeting, we have as many as 50 people attending. About half are online via Zoom, and half are in person at the BP Energy Center, Midtown Anchorage. And we've met for up to four times a month. For as much as a whole day work session, and that was in support of actually the bill that you have in front of you today was a month's worth of work group meetings to discuss and provide input and our thoughts on that. So there's pretty diverse representation on our work group. It's about half corporations, about a quarter state agency folks, so the DNR, AOGCC, the Department of Environmental Quality, ADEC, and the last quarter is one-eighth from the university and another eighth from federal, non-governmental organizations, and the public. So the University of Alaska Fairbanks has the lead role in this, and there's two other co-leads for the work group who represent industry and state government. So we meet weekly and try and plan out what are the work group's next steps. So the Department of Energy funding actually supports this University of Alaska Fairbanks-led work group via the Plains CO2 Reduction Regional Carbon Sequestration Partnership, or PCOR. And we've gotten a lot of technical support from that group. So there's our work group and our little logo up in the top right. So pretty. So this is a pretty important slide. If you look at the box in the top left, the former the presenter earlier actually talks a couple of times, mentioned the National Petroleum Council's meeting the dual challenge, a roadmap to carbon capture deployment. And I really like that study, and I encourage anyone with interest to follow up on that. And so the tagline that dual challenge represents is the world faces the dual challenge of increasing energy demand while addressing the risks of climate change. So 80% of the world's population is below the poverty line. You know, if every one of those people burned a half a cup of kerosene a day, I mean, that's a tremendous amount of fuel. And providing energy to the world and also addressing carbon dioxide and carbon capture is what this work group is all about. And what the technology evolution that's emerging in front of us as an opportunity is that carbon capture and storage can greatly reduce emissions from these plants. And that's what's charted here. You can see there different styles of plants here from the left to the right with decrease. These are electrical generation systems in this case. And the little bubbles above each of these plants, that's the vertical bar that proportional to the amount of carbon dioxide released, tons of CO2 per gigawatt hour of electricity generated. And if you look at an old style traditional coal-fired power plant, it's around 1,100 tons of CO2 per gigawatt hour. But if you take a modern CO2 or coal plant with a second generation carbon capture system, it's less than 100 tons. So it's a tenfold reduction in the amount of carbon emitted. And when you add beneficial use, so some people talk about CCS, which is carbon capture and storage, or CCUS, adding use, or carbon capture, use, and storage. An example of use we heard earlier was enhanced oil recovery, but the earlier presenter talked about food grade CO2. So Alaska right now imports all of its CO2 for Pepsi Colas and whatnot. One concept is you could make a power plant and use its heat and emitted carbon dioxide to enable an agricultural facility to be based here in Alaska. And a relatively small amount of acreage with the enhanced growth opportunities that heat and carbon dioxide could present really could be an energy security and food security opportunity for the state. And if you look in the top right of the diagram, so we talk about carbon capture, but it's a system of processing the gas that comes out of a plant if you're talking about post-combustion capture. So you're not only reducing 90-95% of the CO2, you're removing 100% of the sulfur dioxide, 50% of the NOx. This particulate matter in microns 10 and 2.5, 70-90% of that. And as particulate matter is definitely something that is affecting health quality in communities that are using fossil energy generated products. putting in these systems is a substantial benefit on all these aspects of pollution. So, and you can see there's several different example plants there. There's a current generation natural gas plant on the order of 500 tons, a new natural gas plant, 400 tons per gigawatt hour. If you have a wind energy system that has, and wind is intermittent, if you back that up with a baseload power supply of a natural gas plant, wind energy actually emits 250 tons per gigawatt hour of power, which compared to a coal-fired plant with carbon capture with the current generation technology is less than 100 tons per gigawatt hour. And lastly, and it's the bottom left box here, speaking to the International Panel for Climate Change, they've estimated the cost of establishing clean energy security, and it is more than twice as expensive to create a clean energy world without carbon capture use and storage. And I guess if you had a power plant, let's say, and it cost you, I don't know, $4 billion to make this big power plant, instead of replacing that entire system, you could add a carbon capture system to that for $1 billion. So you can see the cost savings, and that's why clean energy security is achieved in a much more cost-effective manner with carbon capture and storage. So this is from the International CCS Knowledge Center, and give them credit for that on this material.
Mr. Fassbend,
yes.
Question from Cinder Klayman.
This is kind of related to from what the prior presenter talked about, how in Alaska we actually are a pretty low emitter
sure.
of CO2. And I guess the question is, if we don't actually emit a lot of CO2 to become a significant player in this CO2 capture, are we really put in a position of having to transport a bunch of CO2 up to Alaska to then be able to effectively inject it into our wells? Because, that's the question.
Hmm. Thank you. And through the chair, Senator Klayman. It's early days in carbon capture. You know, we have goals that by 2050, 2070 to be net zero. And so I'm not sure what all those projects will look like. But the example on the screen here is talking about a coal-fired power plant as an example. And even though it's not much on the sort of United States total emissions scale, but I think what this is all about, this is a world facing the dual challenge. And establishing the laws and framework here in Alaska enable us to do our part. So if our emissions for stationary sources is 14 million tons per year, well, that's what we have to take care of. And it may be possible that we put these systems in and it's used for enhanced oil recovery instead of for pure sequestration. And we do happen to have some oil fields that really love CO2 for enhanced oil recovery. But if the opportunity is there, there are 6 coal-fired power plants in the state, and those are all available for carbon capture. And we do have, and the technology will continue to evolve. Right now, the cost estimates are natural gas fired systems, which is South Central and the North Slope predominantly. Those are more costly than the current 45Q, $85 per ton. With time, those should evolve towards higher efficiency and lower cost. So if we have 14 million tons, that's our opportunity to address, and we'll see what else the future might hold.
Thank you. We have 35 minutes left, and you have 30 slides remaining.
Most of those are backup. Always, I'm an engineer. I always have a contingency plan. So I won't dwell on this, but this is another picture of carbon capture, transport, use, and storage. And there's two images on the top left for capture. That one is capture from a fossil or a biomass fueled power station, an industrial facility, or directly from the air. So as per the question from Senator Klayman, I could envision a system where you could have a wind farm, and when the wind is blowing and you've got a ton of wind in certain areas in Alaska, it could drive a direct air capture system, and then which captures CO2 directly out of the atmosphere. And then that CO2, you want to put it someplace safely out of the way. And the place to put that is subsurface storage, permanently storing it in an underground geologic formation, like a depleted gas reservoir. You know, we have many, unfortunately, relatively depleted gas fields in South Central. So you could envision a wind farm driving direct air capture and storing it in a depleted natural gas field as a use example. So I am using this slide with permission from the Department of Natural Resources, who talks about the foundational elements: geologic storage potential, a stakeholder engagement, and a regulatory framework to make this all a legal thing to do. Another cool diagram of what this process looks like. So I mentioned a depleted gas field. That's not my typo. I left it there from the British Geological Society. Maybe that's like a British spelling. I don't know. CO2 injection into a saline aquifer is the other example, and that's a significant possibility. We have both in the state, both saline aquifers, which are deep subsurface, and depleted gas fields.
So on that point, Mr. Passavant, actually I asked DNR about that, and they were not sure that we had saline aquifers in Cook Inlet.
So the Cook Inlet system, Senator, was deposited in a relatively freshwater environment, so it's low total dissolved solids. I believe the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission has rules that protect the underground sources of drinking water, and the water that's offshore Cook Inlet is not deemed a source of drinking water, and as such, because it's so far away from people, because it's under the ocean kind of a thing, so they have put in place exemptions for the injection projects in that area, is my understanding. But it's something that AOGCC has on their radar and is considering that. And I will say that both the DNR, ADEC, and AOGCC are looking at this very closely. They have active participation in this work group. They're aware of these issues. In fact, we have an email chain going with between PCOR, AOGCC, and others to address that exact issue. So we have highly talented subsurface professionals who are looking into that problem.
Thank you.
Yeah. So on February 21st, the Assistant Secretary of Energy, Brad Crabtree, presented the following bullet points at Alaska Pacific University. They held a one-day workshop on carbon capture. These are my own personal notes from that meeting. So the United States has a leading role in carbon capture globally. The bipartisan infrastructure law addresses all the elements of CCUS and in a holistic way. And then last year, the Inflation Reduction Act showed up with a ton of additional funding for this. So $300 billion in clean energy investments, including the 45Q credits that were mentioned previously. And these involve co-investment by the federal government, and I should emphasize that these are federal government dollars, not state dollars, and industry. So the early project funding is 80% from the federal government, 20% from the industry. later stages tend to move towards a 50-50 investment framework, plus providing loan guarantees. So there's definitely investment money out there for this, both in the private sector and at the federal level. Assistant Secretary Crabtree says noted that the Cook Inlet has world-class storage, and it's on the Pacific shoreline available. And so there is possibility that may be an opportunity. He also noted that Alaska's electrical grid is unique in the United States. It's separate. It's small. It has a small amount of carbon, only 14 million tons per year, and he sees it as has the potential for decarbonization of the grid itself. And he also noted that he's impressed that Alaskans are agents of opportunity. So we'll have to see where that takes us. A quick note, these are just some funding opportunity examples that when I put these slides together, these were notices of intent. I believe these came out actually for release last week. But on the left, pilot programs, large-scale pilots, $820 million for 10 projects across the United States. On the right, $1.7 billion for 6 projects for demonstration projects. So there's funding opportunities out there. And this is another slide. The next slide is also from the Alaska Department of Natural Resources, shows which states in the United States have or are developing sovereign legislation. And this was on the states with comprehensive legislation is on the left, and then the states with Class 6 primacy or who are seeking it is shown on the right. Pretty extensive effort by the Department of Natural Resources went into researching all of that. I won't go into that discussion. I believe that's already been held or will continue to be held in future conversations. But to my thinking, this is an example of how active this topic is, not only here in Alaska, but it's being actively pursued across the United States. And in the Midwest, where there is a lot of oil and gas development, places which use coal for heat and electricity, just like Alaska, and some pretty chilly places. So,
Mr. Pasvan, at the opening, you mentioned something about North Dakota. So if you'll go back to the previous slide there, you cite one of the green states there is North Dakota.
Yes.
My understanding is actually they achieved Class 6 primacy several years ago.
Yes.
And have been sequestering gas. In fact, they've been, apparently, there's a pipeline from Wyoming to North Dakota. So I'm assuming you must know something about what they're doing. The other thing that I've been told is that Japan has been in communication with North Dakota in regards to sequestering CO2 there, shipping it from Japan. So in my query to the governor's office, the governor apparently had spoken in Japan with them about sequestering, of course, in our Cook Inlet, which is far closer, of course, and would not require a pipeline. What can you tell us about those issues?
Well, firstly, North Dakota has established Class 6 primacy many years ago, and so they're an active hub now for taking CO2 from other locations. You can see, so there's as discussed by the earlier presenter, the capture of carbon dioxide from an ethanol plant is relatively lower cost because it's a much higher concentration of carbon dioxide. And so folks are going to places, so you might have an ethanol plant which has CO2 available, but as you can see, whilst they might be seeking it, they don't have it now. So you might find a way to either send it south to Texas for enhanced oil recovery or north to North Dakota or Wyoming for storage, because those are the places where it's the legislation, the Class 6 primacy are both in place, and that creates that opportunity to invest and make projects happen. I think there's many conversations going on, both in the Asia Pacific and you know other locations. people are trying to figure out how to make this work. It may not work to take CO2 to North Dakota because of transportation via pipeline or cost or some other matter. They will be looking though. So that's all I can really say. I don't have any inside information in that space.
Thank you. Senator Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair. For either of the presenters, I noticed back on slide 11 where the term long-term liability, as far as a maintenance requirement that we would have, I think, can you describe a little bit what the maintenance program might be? If let's say we have a long-term operation where we're injecting carbon, we get to the point where that's a pretty mature operation. What might the maintenance requirements for that to retain that stored carbon be under an active injection process?
So through the chair, Senator Kaufman, these projects, let's say the state sought and realized Class VI primacy for managing the injection well. That's part of it. And the ongoing operations for it. There's also long-term relationship with the EPA, who manages the MRV, or monitoring, reporting, and verification. And the MRV is administered by the Environmental Protection Agency to make sure that CO2 is going where it was intended to go, and that is not affecting any other zones, and verifying the volumes that are being stored there. And that's part of the process that an investor would have to establish to be eligible to earn the 45Q credits. So there's costs associated with that monitoring for offset wells to check other zones to make sure you're not seeing any pressure impacts or things like that. There's also the potential use of seismic to evaluate where is the CO2 in the subsurface. Is it staying where it's intended, or is it moving over time to a different part of the reservoir due to, say, for example, a subsurface pressure gradient that might be in place? But these are examples of the verification steps that would be administered by the EPA for any project, even if it was done here in Alaska.
If I could add, the Class VI permitting hearing that we went through in North Dakota addressed this very issue on the record, and so you might have someone on your staff pull the Class VI permits that have been issued in North Dakota, and you can see in their discussion and analysis of what the long-term cost to maintain the reservoir there would be.
And we will be having state departments coming to us and presenting that information later on during the week, as well as our state geologists talking about the integrity of the wells, the reservoirs that are available in Cook Inlet. Senator Klayman, you had a question.
So for one of the two of you, there was talk about the Class VI wells and getting primacy, and we have not started that process to apply. What is the typical timeline to apply and get primacy, and how essential is having primacy as a state to actually being actively engaged in a carbon credit market, not going to North Dakota to send carbon, but actually bring the carbon here?
Through the chair, Senator Klayman. So Class VI primacy is it takes between 2 to 4 years. It's an application process that the EPA is encouraging. They really want states to seek primacy. The EPA has only permitted 2 Class VI injection wells across the entire country, and Alaska's part of EPA Region 10, which has permitted exactly zero. So, and I believe their office is either in California or Oregon. Now, if Alaska wants to show the developers that we are open for business, we need to seek Class 6 primacy, and we need to establish the regulatory framework. That's not me talking. That's the work group's finding. Over 85%, we did a poll on this topic in the work group, and it was overwhelmingly supportive, because for a project to move forward, and these are very expensive capital investments that take multiple years, and folks are for a project to be eligible for 45Q tax credits, they must start construction by 2032, which is only 9 years from now. And if the EPA has never done a Class 6 injection permit in their jurisdiction in Region 10, that would be a significant risk for an investor to consider Alaska compared to another jurisdiction where in North Dakota it might take a year.
So in Senate Bill 49, you'll see the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission will be empowered to seek that primacy. And we'll be doing the sectional through the bill on Friday, so you'll see that. It's actually in Section 31 if you want to read ahead in the bill. Did you have a follow-up, Senator Klayman?
Is it even worth trying to go down the path of carbon credits until we've gotten the Section 6 primacy approved? I mean, it sounds like if we don't have Section 6 primacy, we're kind of out there not really having a lot to, not much we can make money on without that Section 6 primacy.
So Class 6 primacy is through the chair, Senator Klayman, a signal that states open for business, and that without that and without the regulatory framework, investors will seek elsewhere. The credits are available through the federal government, and the 45Q tax credits, $85 per ton for geologic storage, and $180 per ton for direct air capture. So those credits are available for investors. And I know of people who are interested in doing direct air capture here in the state of Alaska, and they would love to see this bill passed so that they could actually take advantage of some of the unique conditions here in Alaska that make direct air capture feasible, more feasible than in, say, warmer climates. And the regulatory framework and Class 6 primacy go hand in hand.
Thank you. That is why it's part of the bill, which we'll be hearing the sectional of. Senator Kawasaki.
Yeah. Thank you, Frank, for being here. I had a question I think we have to back way up about the carbon capture and storage provision, or just in general. We talked, I think, at the end of the last presentation by Mr. Greeson about the long-term liability of CO2 that's stored. And, whether it's stored in either saline aquifers or underneath a cap of, whatever shale, that actually will remain there and will remain there for a long period of time. Can you talk just a little bit more about that, sort of how it works and whether it is a permanent type fixture or whether there's any liability going forward?
Thank you, Senator Kawasaki, through the chair. We've actually already been storing CO2 in Alaska for decades on the North Slope. So the gas, we know Prudhoe Bay and Point Thompson have quite a bit of carbon dioxide in them, 12.5% CO2 in Prudhoe, 4.5% CO2 in Point Thompson, as an example. And the gas that's produced there, is reinjected into the reservoir, and in fact is a very effective enhanced oil recovery technique due to lean gas vaporization. A whole nother conversation, but Prudhoe Bay has one of the highest recovery factors of any oil field on the planet, and is taught in petroleum engineering schools around the globe because of the gas reinjection cycling project and its phenomenal recovery. And a big part of that is because there's CO2 in that. Carbon dioxide is a pretty phenomenal fluid. They use it in Europe as a dry cleaning fluid because it goes after the oil and it cleans it off the clothes, and they pull it out of the dryer and CO2's gone and the stain's gone with it. The diagram on the screen actually shows an example of injection of CO2 under multiple layers of shales into a permeable formation. And the selection of that is very site specific. And it's reviewed. You need to drill a geologic appraisal well to determine the quality of the injection formation and its storage volume, and the reservoir seal or above that. And those processes are things that Alaska does very well. You know, we've been injecting for decades in Prudhoe Bay, and injected 16 trillion cubic feet if you count the recycled gas through, and it's been geologically secure. So that's the job of the AOGCC as this bill is written. They would take management of that, and that's why they have a team of experienced professionals, geoscientists and engineers, who have that responsibility on behalf of the state to manage and ensure that that is a secure process.
Thank you.
Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. for being here. So, you mentioned in your presentation that construction has to start just 9 years from now, and you talk about primacy taking 2 to 4 years to get. You know, the governor has pretty explicitly not put this forward as a climate change solution, but rather a revenue-generating opportunity. And there's a several hundred million dollar placeholder in the governor's budget right now that says other revenue, and this is the only revenue measure he's put forward. So my question to you is, How soon can Alaska start to generate revenue from carbon storage?
So through the chair, Senator Dunbar, it's going to take some time. These are capital investments that take 5 or 6 years from an investment decision. I went to the Corps regulatory roundup in September. Louisiana talked about it's seeking primacy from the EPA, and that they're encouraging developers to co-apply. So apply to the EPA and submit the same application to the authority who will take Class 6 primacy if they earn that from the EPA. So the Class 6 injection process can be expected to take 2 to 4 years if it stays with the EPA, or it could be less than that if Alaska seeks it and earns that. I have been informed that the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission actually has sent a letter to the EPA saying that they're interested in this process. The reason they sent that letter is because the EPA has set aside a $50 million fund for any state that is interested in seeking primacy. They don't have to actually apply for it. There's costs of evaluating the process and things. So if we're obviously interested, there's people on the state who spent time drafting this legislation as an example. So the EPA has set aside $50 million. I don't think all 50 states will apply. You know, there are places that are not geologically amenable to carbon storage. So there's something over $1 million available if the state seeks that.
Brief follow-up.
Yes, follow-up.
So I appreciate all that. And I know that this is sort of difficult to answer directly, but I don't think you really answered my question, which is, you know, 5 to 6 years from an investment decision, and maybe 2 to 4 years to seek primacy, but we're maybe going to accelerate that a little bit through this process you described. Us as a landowner, us, the state of Alaska as a landowner, how long until we are actually making money off of this?
So through the chair, Senator Dunbar, it will it depends on the project, and the earliest I've seen timelines for if they started today is on the order of 5 or 6 years.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank
you. And if I may, the concept around carbon capture is that we're in it for the long haul, and we're on a journey towards net zero that might take 30 to 50 years. So it's an opportunity for Alaska to get in early and create a long-term new opportunities for investment. So kind of balance the long-term against the what might happen over the next few years.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Kaufman.
Thank you, through the chair, to Mr. Pasqua. Following the discussion that we just had around kind of the timeline, have you seen like a level one master project schedule with some of these key milestones on it, or like not necessarily fully optimized, but kind of realistic time frame?
So through the chair, Senator Kaufman, I have been working on a case study under which I'm under a non-disclosure agreement, because early projects, it's difficult to say where it might head. But what I will say is they have a project schedule on the order of, say, 6 years for a potential capture project that would generate electricity, basically clean electricity, and make that available at lower cost than the current system generation power.
Ola?
Thank you. Yep. And through the chair, sorry if I put you in a bit of a spot with that. I guess what I'm thinking of is what might help understanding of this. If we saw the concurrent activities, if like in a theoretical carbon capture project, active capture where we're pumping it into the ground, where you're seeing, you know, the stacked and distributed things that we need to do. So we need to get regulatory pieces in place. We need to get our permitting regime in place. So these are just all project deliverables that I think if we had a kind of a model of what, I know there's no, everything's unique, but within all that uniqueness, there's kind of a thumbnail of what a typical project might be if we were to start getting these components in place, you know, our permitting, primacy, et cetera. So I don't know if anybody's working on what just a good target schedule, you know, level one master schedule with primary deliverables to kind of do a carbon project. But I think that would be a helpful thing for people to see so that we understand some of the things that have to be in place. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Kaufman. And through the chair, the study that I worked on is we're currently working on a publicly available version of that document, which should include a schedule of that nature. So and it should be available, you know, in the near future. Yeah.
So,
Mr.
Pasben, could I have you go to slide 13, which is your next one? We have about 5 minutes left. And you've got some opportunities on here that might be helpful for the committee to think about in the last few minutes.
Certainly.
If you'd proceed.
So thank you. Shown on the screen is a roadmap by region, by basin, the North Slope, Interior, and South Central. There are particular advantages, like the North Slope has low-cost natural gas available. And it also has significant natural gas-fired equipment, so that's an opportunity for capture. As shown in the earlier presentation, that's economically challenging to do capture on natural gas because it's very low concentration, around 3%. But as technology evolves, perhaps that'll become an opportunity. I mentioned direct air capture as an option, and it could be fired by low-cost gas. Subsurface data gathering in integration, there's a ton of data on the North Slope and from all the oil and gas development. Integrating that data to understand the reservoir, as we discussed earlier, where would be the best places on the North Slope to store that would be a great project to do, and something that we're thinking about. How can the university play a part in that space to help characterize the pore space for the state? As I mentioned earlier, we do have a 40-year track record of successful CO2 sequestration on the North Slope, around 15 trillion cubic feet. And the 2015 LNG plan, actually, that was approved by the AOGCC for major gas sales back then, was to separate and re-inject the gas treatment plant byproduct back in the reservoir as a secure way, and the AOGCC approved that plan as a secure storage location. For the interior, we have existing coal plants, 6, and coal-fired capture is economically attractive at the current 45Q levels, but we need basic regional subsurface data gathering in that area. There's not been the extensive drilling of that to see what the layers look like underground. And so a data gathering project would be appropriate for the interior. South Central does have the proximity to port. It has the potential for import. Capture is not attractive at the natural gas plants or refineries due to the natural gas has a relatively high price, and there's the shortfall in gas supply. So the process takes energy driven by natural gas, and that honestly is a person who heats his house with natural gas, I'd hate to see it burnt there rather than keeping the lights and heat on for users. Coal or hydrogen power generation with CCS can address the natural gas shortage, help food security in the area, and generate low emissions, low carbon intensity. And I will say this, the global thinking is moving away from specificity around renewables, and what they're targeting now is more thinking about the outcomes, a low carbon intensity energy, and that's what this achieves, is lowering the carbon intensity. So if you happen to have your backyard a bunch of coal, and you can hook up a way to get your electricity and your heat from that, and capture the carbon and make it low carbon intensity, that's the technology breakthrough that carbon capture unlocks. Like the North Slope, South Central has a ton of subsurface data, and a project to integrate that data would be very appropriate. And for a particular injection project, site-specific data gathering would be also necessary if there's not a local well available. And most of these wells were drilled for hydrocarbons, so going after a different zone, which might be water-filled, you may have to go get new data to determine the qualities of both the formation and the seal. So just because we have drilled a well there doesn't mean we have sufficient information. And a project that's another part of the element on the schedule is getting the subsurface data to be sure that you've got a project and a place to put the CO2. So I started with this slide, and I'll finish with it. It's what our work group is doing, and the why behind that. And thank you for your time and attention. open. I guess we're open for questions.
Well, we've actually come to the end of our time, but I want to thank Mr. Greeson, Mr. Pasvan. Thank you very much. This was a very rich conversation. Obviously, the committee has a lot more questions. We'll be hearing this subject again on Wednesday with some additional folks that will be talking more about the geologic aspects and also some more about the business aspects. So that concludes our meeting for today. The next meeting is Wednesday, March 8th at 3:30 p.m. And at this time, we will adjourn. The time is 5 p.m.